listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I would wager there's scarcely a person in this room whose life hasn't been touched by Alzheimer's in some way. The disease has already affected 5 million people in the U.S. alone and is poised to become one of the world's greatest epidemics. It's no wonder a whole generation worries that today's memory lapse is a telling sign. So tonight we'll get to hear from one of the great experts. Dr. Gary Small is the director of the UCLA Longevity Center at the university's Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior and professor of psychiatry at UCLA's Geffen School of Medicine and as well the author of 5 books. When does he sleep? That may be one of the questions. Dr. Small was named by Scientific American as one of the world's top innovators in science and technology. His research boldly challenges the widely accepted theory that Alzheimer's disease is an unavoidable consequence of aging. And tonight he'll discuss what he calls the Alzheimer's Prevention Program with Dr. Linda Erkley and his wife and co-writer, Gigi Vorgan, who with Dr. Small has written the New York Times bestseller, The Memory Bible, as well as The Memory Prescription, The Longevity Bible, and The Other Side of the Couch. They will also be signing their books afterwards, courtesy of our library store, so you'll have a chance to meet them at the book signing as well. In conversation with Dr. Small and Gigi Vorgan tonight is Dr. Linda M. Erkley, an associate clinical professor and the director of geriatric psychology in the Department of Psychiatry and Biobehavioral Sciences at the UCLA Semmel Institute. And she has expertise in the neuropsychology of aging and dementia. She's been active in developing cognitive enhancement intervention programs for older adults with age-related memory changes. So we're going to strengthen our memories tonight. We are going to remember this program long after tonight. And please join me in welcoming Dr. Gary Small, Gigi Vorgan, and Dr. Linda Erkley. Thank you.
Well, Gary, everyone, thank you and welcome. It's a pleasure to be here tonight and to be able to have a conversation with Gary and Gigi about their new book, The Alzheimer's Prevention Program, and Keep Your Brain Healthy for the Rest of Your Life. So welcome to the both of you.
Thank you.
I think we'll just start out with my impression so far. I read the book. And
that's a good thing.
It's a good start. Yeah. I have to because I have to work with you, so I better read that book. But I was really impressed with the fact that you're able to present information in such an understandable, digestible way. And yet you come from, of course, a very hard science background, and Gigi, you're a gifted writer. But I'm really interested to know about not only your marriage, but the marriage of your two styles, your two backgrounds, in how you put this book together. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
So I write the first draft, and it generally has a structure: introduction, methods, results, and discussion. And then Gigi sort of transforms it into something people can understand.
He writes like a doctor. So it's hard to read it, unless it's on computer. And I make it sound I put it into layman's speech.
So it's actually been a process. And it for a number of years, there was a literary agent we've worked with, Sandy Dykstra, and she had wanted me to write a book. And she would pair me up with other ghostwriters, and it just didn't seem to work. And then I think that was with the Memory Bible. Mm-hmm. That idea was kind of on our minds, and I wrote the first draft, and I kept asking Gigi, "Would you just take a look at this? You know, could you?"
I used to write for television and movies, and so I have a different style.
But that's very important.
So I did take a look at it,
and really helped create a voice so that it was understandable and accessible to a wider audience. And I think over the years, I think Gigi's become a better scientific thinker, and I think my writing style has improved, so we've learned from each other, which is really wonderful.
Right. Gigi, how was it for you to take the kind of research methodology? I mean, what you described is how one writes a research paper. You start with a background, you go into methods, mm-hmm. you go into results and discussion. How was it for you to extract what you needed to do your thing?
It was difficult at first. You know, I had to learn I had to ask a lot of questions. What does this word mean? And, but it's a skill, I think, you know, more so than an art necessarily, you know, understanding what he's saying mm-hmm. and then thinking about how I would say it.
Right.
Or friends of mine would say it, or people that I know would say it or understand it. And then keeping it in Gary's voice.
Exactly.
Still keeping it in Gary's voice, but making it more conversational.
Definitely.
And more understandable.
I've noticed that when I read it. I've known Gary since the mid-90s. Gary's been my mentor. You have critiqued my writing many times. And when I read that book, I don't see a difference. I don't see two minds writing this book. I see one mind in the book, and it does sound very much like Gary's voice. So thank you for bringing that to people's attention, because I know from my personal experience with Gary and listening to your talks, many of your talks, that this book very much reflects more of that approach of talking to patients and talking to people, which I think is so important, because this is who is the consumer of all the research that's out there on Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, I think it's a challenge in medicine. I think doctors aren't really taught to do that.
Right.
And I remember in medical school, when I was doing my surgery rotation, I think what the surgical resident would do, he would just speak louder and more slowly, thinking the patient would understand all the technical terms.
Right.
And it didn't work.
They walk out of the room going, what?
What was he saying? Yeah.
So over the years, you have produced a great body of research, particularly in the early detection of dementia. When I came on board, we were working with brain scans. Mm-hmm. You did some of that groundbreaking work on a genetic risk for Alzheimer's disease. How or what motivated you to write this book, a book on prevention?
So we just, you know, heard a moment ago how so many people are affected by Alzheimer's disease, and there's so much in the news right now on it. I mean, every day you pick up the paper, and one day they say, take vitamin E, and then the next day they say, don't take vitamin E. And even for us who are in the field, it's confusing. So I just thought it was a good time to really try to tackle this subject and to try to make sense of all this new research, try to translate it into a language where people could understand and put it into perspective. And it was clear to me that this idea of prevention or the connection between lifestyle and brain health was critical, and we needed to make a strong statement about it and try to present something practical for people so it would have meaning.
Well, as you say in the book, genetics is only responsible for a certain amount of what causes Alzheimer's, and the right. other parts are lifestyle factors.
Right. So it's about, there's a formula. If you look at the MacArthur study of successful aging, so they defined successful aging as physical and mental success or cognitive success. About a third of what determines our success as we age comes from genetics, what we inherit. So that means two-thirds, as Gigi mentioned, is non-genetic, and we're learning so much more about lifestyle choices and behaviors that contribute to those non-genetic determinants of our brain health.
Do you ever get any pushback from the field on prevention?
Well, we've had tremendous pushback, and okay. It's been interesting and surprising to me. And I think in part this stemmed from a consensus conference, and right. I'm sure you're aware of last year, where a group of scientists got together and they reviewed the available scientific information or studies on Alzheimer's prevention. And they concluded we can't definitively say that we can prevent Alzheimer's disease. And I think the way they looked at the question, I would have to agree with them if they were doing what we call a meta-analysis, where you compare lots of different studies. But there are weaknesses in that approach. And they don't really tell this whole story. All they're telling you is that we haven't proven it with this method. And we would probably need a 10, 20-year study, like a Framingham Alzheimer's prevention study, mm-hmm. to prove it. And, you know, I don't want to wait 20 years for people to tell me I should not smoke and I should live a healthy lifestyle. But they also said, if you read the fine print, that they're very encouraged by the short-term studies, by the clinical trials that have been done. And another way to look at it is that we know that two of the key Alzheimer's prevention strategies, healthy diet and physical exercise, we know that it will prevent diabetes. Mm-hmm. And we also know from actually a recent Japanese study that if you have diabetes, that doubles the probability that you're going to get Alzheimer's disease. So just by the simple logic, gee, if you can prevent diabetes, you're also going to prevent Alzheimer's disease.
Also, when you say prevent, what do you personally mean by prevent?
What we're talking about is really staving off symptoms, delaying the onset of symptoms. And if you look at the scientific evidence, it's fairly compelling that if you walk briskly every day for a half hour, or if you eat fish several times a week, or if you follow this lifestyle strategy, you may delay the onset of symptoms by a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Or more.
Or more, 3 years, 4 or more years. And for many people, that may mean never getting symptoms in their lifetime.
Right.
So that's about as close as we can get to a cure today for many people.
How does this ring for you, Gigi, in being around all of this? I read the book, you're mentioned in the books, you're mentioned in all of Gary's books. Actually, and I'm thinking about in
she
writing,
has final approval of all of this.
Yeah, apparently. Well, a little more than that. But how is it for you to, you know, any personal impact coming from a totally different field? You know, how has this impacted you?
Well, I'm very interested. My mother has Alzheimer's disease, and Gary actually helped her stave it off for quite a while. But she has it, and it's a terrible experience. It's a terrible thing for a family to go through. If anybody here has experienced that with a family member, it's very difficult. And so it's affected me that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure that she did stave it off for some time. But, you know, I don't freak out every time I can't find my keys.
Right.
And think it's happening.
Self-diagnosing.
When you can't find the cars, when you freak out.
Yeah, that's a little worse. But so it's touched my life in several ways, you know, with my mother and with myself, and I follow the program.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel healthier and good about it.
I think when you're reading about the science and you're writing the books, I mean, we can't help but start changing our own lives. And I think for both of us, you know, we're living a much healthier lifestyle then at least I'm living a much healthier lifestyle. Gigi was always pretty healthy. and I think it has an impact on your life personally. And I think, you know, we joke about it with your mother. It really is painful to see someone. I mean, I've lived and breathed this for decades in the science, taking care of thousands of families and patients. But I think when it hits your own life personally, it's very different. You really see those emotional challenges and struggles and how difficult it is. I remember, you know, with your mother, you know, I've known her for decades, but not as long as you've known her. And she began to forget my name.
You know, recently.
Yeah, before she, you know, forgot other people who she's known longer. So those shorter term memories are much less stable than the longer term ones. And typical for her of many patients, you know, she seems to perk up when people talk to her in her native tongue, in Hungarian.
That's true.
So you really see that difference. But it's a real heart-wrenching disease, and we really have to do something about it. And for us, writing this book was something we could do right now. Give people something where they can protect their brains, feel improvement in their memory performance very quickly, and buy some time while we're waiting for science to catch up. Because, as you know, we're working very hard and trying to find more effective treatments every day.
A portion of the book is a foundation in education about Alzheimer's disease. And get asked this question a lot by patients that I work with, or if you're giving a talk, you hear it too, it really tags on to what Gigi just said. How can you tell when someone is taking a turn and going down the road towards Alzheimer's? What are things that would be something to make would be a red flag, or to make me take notice, or make someone say, I think we need to go see our doctor about this?
Well, it's often challenging because Alzheimer's dementia in the early stages looks very much like normal aging. And the things we often joke about, where did I put my keys? Oh my God, I can't find my car in the parking lot. What's that person's name? Those kinds of things.
Having a senior moment.
Right, senior moment or middle age pause. And that's normal. I mean, in fact, a recent study found that by age 45, we can measure that, and people have that. But it doesn't tend to progress. It tends to be relatively stable, and we compensate for it. As it gets a little worse, then people segue from normal aging to what we call mild cognitive impairment. So there, people are compensating more. They're spending more time trying to hold it together, but they're still independent. If you have mild cognitive impairment, though, your risk for getting Alzheimer's dementia is about 10% per year. And if it worsens, then people have dementia and they need help from others. So I think the question, when should you get help or find out about it, is when you're concerned. I mean, when in doubt, ask your doctor. And if you feel your doctor doesn't have the expertise, you know, go to a specialist, get a consultation with someone who's comfortable with it. Because we find that if people get treatment earlier, they seem to have better outcomes.
So what would be a better outcome? Can you explain that a little bit about what's a better outcome?
Well, right now, you know, if you have a memory problem that might be treatable with a medication or might be Alzheimer's dementia, the doctor might start you on what we call a symptomatic drug. You've probably heard the names of them, like Aricept and Exelon and Namenda. They don't cure the problem, but they can sometimes improve the symptoms temporarily or at least stabilize the problem, and people might gain a year or two of better functioning. And so what some of the studies suggest, if you get started on these medicines when you have mild Alzheimer's dementia, the outcome eventually might be better than if you wait until it's more severe.
Which leads me to the next question before we get into some specifics about the book. But in the book, you did mention in real estate, it's location, location, location. In Alzheimer's prevention, it's timing, timing, timing. What What do you mean by that?
So here's a typical situation in this area. In the late 1990s, the Baltimore Longitudinal Study found an association between taking anti-inflammatory drugs like Aleve or Motrin for two or more years and having a 60% lower risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. Now, that didn't prove cause and effect, but it led scientists to now take drugs like ibuprofen and put patients with Alzheimer's disease on it versus a placebo inactive sugar pill. And they found it didn't work. And then what they do, okay, forget anti-inflammatories, let's go on to the next thing. So the problem, there's a couple problems with that approach. And the first problem was that they took a drug that might delay the onset of symptoms and treated people who already had the symptoms. So it was too little, too late. And in fact, we did a study a few years ago where we took another kind of anti-inflammatory drug and gave middle-aged people who had very mild memory complaints that drug for 18 months, and we found it actually did improve memory, and it helped with brain function. And other studies have found that it's possible that these anti-inflammatory drugs may be helpful when people have very mild complaints, but actually could make things worse once they have Alzheimer's dementia. So I think that's just a case in point. And let me just say that we don't have enough information about when there's this tipping point where the medicine may not be helpful and when it may be helpful. And also, we know that these drugs have a lot of side effects. So we're not at the stage where we recommend anti-inflammatory drugs to protect the brain. If you're taking them for arthritis or aches and pains under a doctor's supervision, it's possible it could also be protecting your brain. So I think that was the idea about timing. It may be true with many other approaches. The brain really changes as it ages, and what may be helpful to it at one point in time may not be so helpful later.
But also, the program described in the book, the longer you're on it, not that there's any time you can't start it. I mean, at any age, you can't start living your life according to this program. But the longer you're on it, the healthier you're going to be and the better for your brain.
So what about your kids then, Gigi? Gary, what about your kids?
I try to keep my kids on the program. You know, the area of food and exercise and all that stuff, we've really driven home to them. You know, they're teenagers. One's going to be 20. And what I can't really control is their stress. One of the areas of the program is trying to reduce your stress.
Right. Yeah.
And they're stressed out every time I show PowerPoint slides on the program at dinner. So it's not a good thing.
Every time you give them a memory test.
So we try to teach them these things. But, you know, I've learned over the years there's two groups of people who tend not to listen to me, my children and my parents. So, but sometimes they do. You hear them say things that they've absorbed, and they know broccoli is good for their brain, and they eat it a lot, and that's good. And I think that it's a good question, because one of the challenges people have is to change bad habits.
Right.
Once they've adopted those habits. And if you can start good habits when you're young, you're better off. And that's really, you know, it gets into what this, we have a 7-day jumpstart program in the book and what that's about. We really wanted to help people change, to really convert the lifestyle into something that they keep up over the years, because as Gigi says, that's going to make the difference. And we all know that, but we can talk about this tonight and everybody's really excited, and then you start exercising and then next week you might forget. It's a little bit like getting a speeding ticket. You go to traffic school and then you drive better for a while and then you forget. So the question is, how do you help people to change? And we tried to bring in some of those elements where we give a jumpstart program so people can see how easy it is, see that it doesn't take that much time. And also hopefully
see some results.
Yeah.
Right.
Quickly.
So, that's very important.
So we have a little assessment tools based on a lot of the stuff we've done at UCLA. We developed these easier tools so you can see results right away. And it's like going on a diet and You get on the scale after a week and say, hey, I lost a couple pounds, and so you're more motivated to continue.
So what makes the Alzheimer's Prevention Program different from other books that are out there on healthy lifestyle?
Sound like our editor, my God.
I'm a tough sell.
You know, I think that one thing is really bringing in the latest science. Mm-hmm. And everything is well detailed scientifically. If you want to read the footnotes, they're there. I think this whole idea of trying to help people to change, to really make it practical, and not to overwhelm them, to just give them 7 days of what it would be like, and also not dictating what you have to do, because we know there's not one way to reduce stress or not one way to have a brain-healthy breakfast. So we give people a lot of choices to individualize what they mm-hmm. want to do and kind of show them a general approach and strategy.
I think that's very important because you can get people very excited about things, but they need, it's like having a trainer. They need a how-to go about making a transition into their life about how to do this. I don't think the program is that difficult because people tend to get very overwhelmed if you tell them, I want you to do this and that and this and that and this and that. And I didn't find that is the case with how you lay out the method. I think there's something in there for everyone to pick up on. Like I do a lot of things. Right. It stems from, in my family, my mother had high cholesterol. So I learned, you know, very young how to watch my diet, mainly because she was watching her diet. And so I formed a habit. So forming a habit is not that bad, but what I noticed in the book is the positivity about forming the habit. So that, you know, you don't go kicking and screaming into, I have to give up all this stuff in order to change my lifestyle or to be healthy. That it seems like you can do little things that seem to go a long way, or well, you can do the whole thing.
Well, I appreciate your saying that because I know you've developed a lot of memory training and lifestyle programs for UCLA, so you know how you have to word it and present it so it's accessible to people.
Right.
You don't want it to be too complicated.
I think accessibility is a big problem because there's like, if you read the research on memory enhancement techniques, and if you read the evidence, and what you write in the book is evidence-based, there is a big wall between the research and what the average person gets to hear about and how it's told to them. There's a wall. It's almost like here's the dividing line, and that's for the audience, and this is for the scientists. And that's a real problem because we're there to do the work for the consumer and for patients and for people. And I think a big important part of the book is that I don't feel like there is a wall there. You know, it is accessible.
Well, I think the other thing we paid attention to in this program is to try to build the exercises gradually so mm-hmm. people get a sense of mastery and they can see how easy it is to improve. In fact, I think we brought some exercises here, didn't we?
All right, yeah, okay. And I think it would be good to share some of them with
We're not going to share the whole program,
no.
But we will kind of
There's not enough time.
So actually, let's talk about memory training,
okay?
Because that's people. You know, we all hear about the brain gymnastics we're supposed to do. You know, people have the sense that if they do enough Sudoku puzzles, they'll get really good at Sudoku.
That's right. That's right.
But actually, what we do have puzzles in the book and brain games, and we try to help people cross-train their brain. Because one of the issues, if you just do Sudoku, it's just one part of your brain. You want to train other parts of your brain and build brain muscle. We've done studies where we found just these kinds of exercises can stimulate neural circuits very quickly.
Definitely.
But probably as important or more important is to learn memory techniques that are practical. And so what we tried to do here is really target those common problems people face. like names and faces and remembering to remember. You run out of the house and your cell phone isn't with you, and you reach for your cell phone to call home and it's not there.
Right.
So it doesn't work.
And that's stress too, big time.
It brings up the stress. Yeah. So those memory techniques build on what we call look, snap, connect. Look is a reminder to focus attention. The biggest reason we don't remember is we're simply not paying attention. We're distracted. Snap is a reminder to create mental snapshots of information. Our brains are hardwired to remember visually. And connect is a way of linking up those mental snapshots so they're meaningful and easy to recall. If something is meaningful, we're much more likely to remember it. So you can apply this approach to names and faces. Linda, you've done it very well in our memory programs at UCLA. Or for errands, if you're running out of the house, let's say I have to get eggs and stamps, I might visualize a big egg in my hand and I see a stamp on it, and then I drop the egg on my shoe, and then I remember, oh yes, I've got to go to the shoe store. So you can have movement and action and make it very visual and memorable. So to show you how easy it is to do this, we have one slide.
One slide.
My kids would be so happy if I only showed them one slide. So the slide, please. So this is a list of 8 unrelated words. And this, you know, we actually do memory assessments like this in the clinic. Mm-hmm. And now if you came into our clinic, you'd be gaming the system. You'd know how to beat
That's
it
true.
From this technique. And so what I want everybody in the audience to do is to come up with a story in your mind where you visualize each of these, what each of these words represents to you. And you, if you put some action or movement in it, you can do that. It can be a logical story. It can be a silly story. Sometimes that works better for people. So I'll read the words, and then just I want you to look, snap, connect. Don't write them down. Just use your brain power to do it. And then maybe in a little while we'll see if somebody will share their story.
Okay.
And here are the words: beach, professor, horse, teddy bear, cigar, nun, palm tree, pasta. Okay. So we can take the slide down now. Thank you.
So remember those words as best as you can, as we would say.
Well, actually, remember your story, because that's going to be more interesting
than
the words.
Gigi, do you use these techniques?
I do.
Yourself?
Actually.
Can you give an example of when you would use something like that?
Well, not necessarily. Well, maybe
or
if I'm going
method.
To the market,
yeah,
and I just have to pick up a few items, I would make a little story, you know, or
we do with parking.
A little thing with parking, like if I'm on 3B, mm-hmm. I might just remember that. Imagine 3 large bees around my car,
mm-hmm.
And
it's very effective. Yeah, we do it all the time with parking spaces. The only people who remember where they park their car every time park in the exact same space each time.
But you know what happens when you don't park in that same space anymore? It really messes you up.
It does, yes.
Are
you upset that I parked in your space last week?
I had to get the cops one time to help me get my parking space. I was so
stressed.
We've
all had those experiences.
Oh, yeah.
They're frightening.
And they knew that no one stole my car. And then I was writing a grant, hello, for us.
So it was my fault.
I was very stressed out. Okay. But it illustrates stress.
But stress actually is a good point, because a lot of times when we have these senior moments, we get stressed out. And the stress makes it worse. And in fact, our studies have found that when you're worried about your memory, you don't perform as well in your memory test. So it's important to kind of calm down, relax, realize it happens to everybody, and that it will come to you. And in fact, in the Alzheimer's prevention program, for the first time I've seen it, we have specific exercises for this tip of the tongue problem. I've never seen it before, where there are systematic approaches to it that are quite effective. So.
Tip of the tongue, meaning like when there's just, you know the word.
It's on the tip of your tongue.
Right, your tongue, and you just can't bring it out.
Right.
You know, unless maybe later when you're not stressing over it.
Definitely.
It just comes to you.
Exactly. But it does come, but there's a way to reactivate your memory circuits.
Well, actually, you can use Look, Snap, Connect to help you with that, too.
Just use the word. Start using it, too. It's very important.
Well, one of the reasons we have that experience is because we're not using that
word. Right.
We've used it in the past, but we're not rehearsing it and practicing it.
That really scares people, though, when that happens.
Yeah. Well, I think especially those of us who have seen it in our families, and also those of us as we age. I mean, age is the greatest single risk factor for getting Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, that's by age 65 or older is about 5-10% of the population. By 85 or older can be as high as 40 or 50%.
Why do you think we're seeing so much Alzheimer's disease now, though? What do you think is going on? Because this is definitely something that's literally, you know, in the news every day. Yeah. Is it that we're having more of it? Is it that we're more aware? What do you think
it is?
Oh,
gee, there's a combination of factors. I think it's the grain of our society. We're getting older. We've got 80 million baby boomers last year. They started turning age 65. So there's more of us. We're more aware of it. We're proactive about these kinds of things. We want to do something about it. There's been more research on it. It probably, in, you know, the first case reported by Alois Alzheimer in 1906, it was somebody with, well, it was 51. And so we thought it was a rare presenile dementia. It wasn't till the 1970s where we figured out that what we called senility, what we thought was a normal part of aging, was actually the same thing. We saw the same problems in the brain. So all of a sudden, we had an epidemic of Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And then we started doing some research on it. And I think we're realizing this is a problem. We've got to deal with it. And it's on our mind. It's in the news. And we're living longer. And we want to live better. We don't want to have it affect our lives.
I've always wondered, too, it's more my commentary than anything, but why, you know, why the pushback on prevention? Because we have prevention for cancer. We have, you know, things to do to prevent cancer, to prevent heart disease. What's the block for people to not think about it for Alzheimer's disease or dementia?
Well, you know, I think we get into semantics. I think there's the issue of people overselling what we can do with these strategies. You know, so people feel, my God, you know, I hear it all the time. People will say, well, you know, so-and-so was mentally active, physically active, and that person still got Alzheimer's. Well, you know, we can't guarantee you're not going to get it, and there's some debate. If we all live long enough, would we all get it? And we don't know the answer to that. There's been famous cases, Madame Jean Calment, who lived to 122, and she did not get it. She had a healthy brain. She's from the south of France, so she had the Mediterranean diet, which is brain healthy.
Tell about her apartment.
Oh, yeah. She was physically active. At 94, she sold her apartment to a French businessman who agreed to pay her rent for the rest of her life.
And then he would get her apartment.
Yeah. But he died 10 years later. So I don't know if that was some kind of a scam or she was onto that or maybe just being a good businesswoman is a brain protective.
She showed him.
So, you know, so I think, you know, there's how you define prevention. I think we don't want to oversell it. We're careful in the book to really tell people what the science shows and what we can expect. But I think sometimes there's politics to the semantics.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that one, definitely. Gigi, let me ask you some questions.
Okay.
So how do you go about individualizing? The book, you talk about individualizing the plan for different people. So how do you individualize, let's say, your plan when you're trying to get your kids off to school, when you've got to do things, right? And yet you have some things that you need to do to take care of yourself. So I know parents tend to sacrifice their own health sometimes because they're so busy doing for their families. So what about you? How do you fit this in?
Well, individualizing is not that difficult. I mean, for instance, if you can't take a jog or a run or whatever in the morning, you might park a distance from your job or your your first destination or whatever, and walk longer. Take the stairs instead of the elevator, and just work your exercise into your life style when if you don't have time for formal exercise. And diet is very easy to adjust to what your likes are. And you know, in the diet we have some people eating omelets and some days and stuff. If there's people who don't like eggs,
right,
there's other ways to get protein and get, you know, a healthy diet and a healthy breakfast. If you mean if you don't have time for breakfast?
Or just, yeah, I think taking time for yourself, or you don't have time for breakfast, or like Gary, you're on the road, you know, those types of situations where people tend to slip or not do healthy things when they're under the time pressure. How do you manage that?
You know, I think a lot of it is planning and kind of trying different options. And as Gigi mentioned, if you do the 7-day program, you sample lots of different foods and recipes. And what we find is people will take away from it what they want, and they'll take away a general approach and an understanding of how to deal with the diet, how much exercise they need. And also, I think there's an attitude of moderation and not being overly strict, so people are not too hard on themselves. And
also, if you miss a day on your program, or you mess up, or, oh my God, I ate some cake, and not that I would ever do that, but you just get right back on. Yeah. You know, it's not going to, like, oh my, send you into the Alzheimer's wing if you miss a day
right.
on your prevention program. We're talking about a lifetime, you know, and a lifestyle here. Right. And I don't think missing a day on the program is going to affect the outcome.
And that's really what the studies show us. I mean, if you look at an epidemiological study showing a connection, say, between eating fish and having a lower risk of Alzheimer's, you know, they didn't find that people had to eat fish exactly on Tuesdays and Thursdays
right.
for their entire life. You know, it's kind of an average of their behaviors.
I think the key is the moderation, because what I noticed is people get, they kind of jump into it. It's like the gym membership. They make their resolution at the beginning of the year that they're going to join the gym and, you know, come out looking like Mr. or Ms. Universe. And they quickly peter out in that goal because they're so hard on themselves that they kind of set themselves up to kind of fail.
True, but if you find after a week or two that your memory is actually improved, that's very encouraging.
Right, definitely.
And that tends to happen on this program.
So then should we find out maybe are there any volunteers in the audience that might want to take a stab at that?
The story?
At that story.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to hear. Anybody have a story?
Don't be
shy. You're a little bit timid there, but...
Yeah.
Is there a microphone
Yes.
I think there's someone right over...
Somebody's got a microphone? Okay. Maybe we'll hear a couple of stories. If we hear this exact same story from two people, we'll know something's up.
Yeah. I saw people passing notes.
That's not fair.
I walked to the beach to smoke a fresh Cuban cigar and saw a professor kissing a nun against a palm tree. And where do we go with this?
This sounds like a treatment for a screenplay. This is
yeah, it does.
And then, let's see. Oh, I had this.
We'll
really
come back
to
you. Well, how about, is there another story? And I like
still
the
fantasizing about the
I'd never heard that before. That's pretty interesting. Did you go to Catholic school, by the way? You did, okay. We got another story.
Once upon a time.
Love the opening. That's great.
Thank you. There was this professor, and he was riding a horse on a beach. He had a cigar in his mouth, a teddy bear in his arms, when he happened upon a nun beneath a palm tree eating pasta, and he joined her.
Excellent. Okay, well, I think...
Hi. Very good.
Nice job. So just out of curiosity, how many people saw the professor smoking the cigar? And how many saw the nun smoking the cigar? Okay, so there's all the Catholic school. And then there was a teddy bear. How many saw the teddy bear? Okay. So I think we can break up into three groups right now and have interesting conversations. So that people, you know from the programs, people have a lot of fun learning this. And so we take it from that level, from the fun part, to making it really practical and empowering people, showing them they can improve.
Sometimes I think people get the sense that, oh, this has to be harder, this has to be complicated. And it doesn't have to be. It can be fun, it can be entertaining, as well as good for you.
And our hope is it's not stressful.
Right. No, it shouldn't be stressful at all.
And we actually give some techniques to help lower your stress.
Can you give an example of a technique?
Care?
Well, I like the interactive thing. Let's do one right now.
Okay.
So you don't have to do this if you don't want to, but you might feel better. So what I want everybody to do is just get comfortable in their chair. Just first kind of become a little bit aware of I noticed I was kind of slipping onto the stage. Take a deep breath, and as you let your breath out, I want you to close your eyes. And just keep breathing slowly, and as you hear me speak, just relax. And I want you to notice the tension in your jaw muscles and just allow yourself to release that tension. Maybe move your jaw around a little bit. Breathing slowly, very relaxed. And become aware of that sense of relaxation and let it spread to your neck muscles and your shoulders and just kind of move them around. Feel very relaxed, breathing very slowly. Take a deep breath and let it out. And open your eyes. And just ask yourself, how do you feel? It's just a little calmer, a little more relaxed. That kind of, it takes maybe 10, 20 seconds. You can do that a minute.
At your desk?
Do it at your desk every few hours. It makes a big difference. Before you have a moment where you have to focus your attention, it's going to improve it. If you're having middle-age pause or a senior moment, try one of those exercises. It may bring back to you whatever memory you're looking for. So those kinds of simple exercises we include in the program, and also a lot of other approaches, an entire chapter on stress management. And some people find that yoga works for them. Others like Tai Chi because they like to move or meditate. Or you can combine strategies. You can take your brisk walk with a friend, so you're getting cardiovascular training, so it's pumping oxygen and nutrients to your brain cells. You're talking about your day, so you're lowering your stress level and blowing off some steam. And just the conversation itself is tweaking your brain cells and exercising them to some extent.
Right, social interaction is very,
very important.
Important,
yeah.
Which I think, because we're going to be opening the floor up to questions in a minute, but that does make a really excellent segue to the fact that we are getting together here and we're doing this as a group. We are having a conversation with all of you. And that this is so important. This is a very important part of the healthy lifestyle, is the socialization, the exchanging of ideas, the learning, the lifelong learning, which is part of the program. And so you cannot, there's no substitute for the human interaction and the human contact. So coming to lectures, having a friend to blow off steam with, all this is part of what you're talking about also in the book. So it really is kind of a going back to something much more natural, I think, considering we're in a world where we touch computer screens instead of touching other people, right? And so what I like about the program, coming from, you know, my background in psychology, is that it's very interactive with people, with the environment, with having a good time, feeling good inside. And I think it opens up the mind, not just on purpose because you're stimulating your brain, but I think it's really about opening up to just people and new things. But it's very important.
Well, I think it's challenging today with all the new technology that distracts us from face-to-face conversations.
I'm going to text you how I feel about that.
He's not multitasking right now.
How do you know I'm not answering email as we speak?
That maybe with your toes, I don't know.
That's right.
So I think now is a good time to open up to the audience for some Q&A. And I know there are going to be microphones passed around.
Good evening. Why is stress so negative?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because a little bit of stress is probably positive. It motivates us to actually do something. The problem, and we've actually, our bodies have adapted to respond to stress in a way that helps us survive, you know, the fight or flight response. So our ancestors, if there was a predator coming at you, you know, your body responds in a way so that the blood flow goes from your stomach, you don't really feel like eating a meal, to your muscles and to your brain. So you think quick and you either run or attack, and that we adapted to that. The problem is when we're under chronic stress, our bodies secrete stress hormones like cortisol. And it turns out if you inject a human volunteer with this stress hormone, it temporarily impairs memory and, you know, learning and recall. Studies of laboratory animals under chronic stress find that the stress actually shrinks the hippocampal memory centers of the brain underneath the temples, and those animals get lost in their mazes. So it's not just the brain that doesn't respond well to chronic stress, it's other organs too, like the heart and so forth. So I think, you know, it's stress itself is not bad. I think what we're talking about is kind of the chronic stress or stress that is that impairs our memory. And then I think at another level, we know that chronic stress can lead to depression and anxiety, and depression can certainly distract us and affect our memory.
Right. In fact, when you're depressed, it's demonstrated that on neurocognitive tests, like if you give people a battery of memory tests, that they have trouble learning, they're slowed down, and they're much more distractible. Yeah. And that when the depression goes away, unless the depression is related to something more physically wrong with the brain, that people tend to get better on those types of tests.
Thank you. Good evening. I would like to know if you think there could possibly be a correlation between the lowering of cholesterol and Alzheimer's.
So, yeah, I mean, we talk about this in the book. If you have hypertension, or if you have high cholesterol, it's really important to treat it, to take your medicine, because that will protect your brain health. And, you know, there have been some studies, actually some of these epidemiological studies, showing that people who take statin drugs seem to have a lower risk for Alzheimer's. Now, it was the same problem that we saw with anti-inflammatory drugs. When they took the statin drugs and they tested them in people with Alzheimer's, didn't always have an impact. But certainly, you know, when we say Alzheimer's disease and age-related memory loss, we didn't get into this before, but often we're talking about amyloid plaques and tau tangles, which are little protein deposits that get into the memory centers of the brain, and we think maybe causing it. We're not absolutely sure. But if you look at people who die of Alzheimer's disease, and you look at their brains, especially if they're older, you see small strokes, you see lots of things that happen. You know, head trauma increases the risk. So what we want to do is live a healthy lifestyle, take care of our medical conditions as best as we can as we age. Whether it's high cholesterol, high hypertension, we want to take care of all those things to protect our brains.
We're in a library, and you wrote a book. I wonder if reading is part of your program.
Only the books we've written. It has not been proven with any of those other books. But, you know, there's a lot of studies showing an association between mental stimulation and a lower rate of getting Alzheimer's. And, you know, probably those first studies, college education. So you go to college, you have a lower risk for Alzheimer's. We know it's true about UCLA. They're still tallying it for USC. But actually, I went to both schools, so I'm protected either way. But actually, in all seriousness, there was a recent study that we cite in the book that you don't even have to go to college. If you continue lifelong learning, you can catch up, and you have that protection. So probably anything you do, you know, whether it's a crossword puzzle or reading, you want to find that sweet spot so you feel your mind is stimulated, and it's probably going to be good for you.
Thank you. Is there any research of whether there's as much Alzheimer's in cultures that have greater communal living, greater, less marginalization of senior citizens than we have in the United States? I mean, I was in El Salvador last year, and they were telling me there is not as great a prevalence of Alzheimer's there. And their supposition is that the older people continue to maintain close connections and are very active in their communities and are not kind of set aside or in isolation as we see in the United States.
Yeah, I've heard that before, and I don't know of studies that have proven that hypothesis from the cross culture. Have you, Linda?
No, I mean,
what we do is some of the studies, I thought you were going to ask about Japan, say.
Well, I was just going to say Japan, there's a study.
Well, but what they find in Japan, seniors tend to stay in the home more than they do here in the United States. But what you find in Japan, there's so many different factors. There's actually a higher rate of vascular dementia. And you think, well, why would there be that? You know, they're eating a lot of sushi and so forth. Well, they're putting a lot of soy sauce on the sushi, which increases your blood pressure, and they're smoking a lot. So there's a lot of lifestyle issues that complicate those studies. There was a study done comparing Nigerians to African Americans. They found less dementia in the Nigerians, and they thought it was the simpler diet, where they weren't eating a lot of fast foods and cheeseburgers and steaks, instead more vegetarian and more physical exercise. So, you know, I think it's an interesting hypothesis to pursue, but I don't know that one they've
there are differences cross-culturally on just the idea or the concept of dementia. So we're very sensitized to it here, but in other cultures, people get absorbed into their family. They might think, oh, this is just grandma, she's aging. So some of it might be semantic, but I still think the risk factor and the social support aspects are really important. I mean, in India, what about the curcumin?
Yeah, so in India, there's a lower rate of Alzheimer's, and that led some investigators to ask the question, well, could it be the diet? And we know they eat a lot of curried foods. There was a big study in Singapore that found that people who ate Indian food more often actually performed better on memory tests. And I think you didn't even have to be eating while you took the test. But more importantly, our scientists at UCLA, Greg Cole and Sally Frausci, have found that curcumin, which is in the curry, it's in turmeric, actually is a potent anti-inflammatory and attacks those amyloid plaques in the brain. And so we're studying it right now. We just got FDA approval to look at a high-potency form of curcumin in people not with Alzheimer's disease, but people at risk. And we're going to use one of our brain scan tools to see if it will prevent the buildup of the plaques as well as prevent Alzheimer's.
Is there a hormonal component to...
Is there a what?
Hormonal component to Alzheimer's?
So there's been a lot of studies looking at hormones, especially estrogen, and epidemiological studies found that women who took estrogen replacement treatment had a lower rate of Alzheimer's, but when they studied that systematically, they found that Premarin in women over age 65 actually accelerated cognitive problems. And so the latest studies that we talk about in the book suggest that hormonal replacement earlier in life may actually be brain protective, but later in life may not be. So it's, again, the issue of timing. So we don't have all the answers about hormones. It probably has some kind of an effect.
There was a recent study published that deep brain stimulation possibly could improve memory. And I know it was a very small study, seven people and also some mice involved. Would you care to comment on that?
So that was a UCLA study, and they did, I think, in epileptic patients.
Right.
And they found that in a certain part of the brain underneath the temples that resulted in some benefit. And so we're actually excited about it, and we're looking to develop a study where we don't have to do surgery to stimulate the brain, but use some other kinds of approaches that are non-invasive to see if we can make it practical and make it available. I think everybody is clamoring for more effective treatments.
Hi, I would like to know if right now UCLA has some genetic and cognitive testing for people whose parents have passed away with Alzheimer's?
There are a lot of studies. Are you asking about a research study or whether there's an assessment program?
Both.
So there are both. So there are research studies that are ongoing. We have an active genetics research group. And also our group, we're always looking for volunteers for studies. And also we have assessment programs. If you go to www.longevity.ucla.edu, you can find out about all of our programs.
My question has to do with diagnosing Alzheimer's. My understanding is, and I may be completely wrong on this, that you can't actually give a definitive Alzheimer's diagnosis until after somebody has died. And I just want to add that we have a friend who, at the age of 58, we thought had early onset Alzheimer's, and it was ultimately diagnosed as frontotemporal dementia. How common is Alzheimer's? How easy is it to diagnose? You know, all of those things.
You ask a lot of questions for somebody from New Jersey, I'll tell you.
I am from New Jersey.
Are you really? That was an old Saturday Night Live joke, but that's amazing. But so you're testing my short-term memory. You asked me so many questions.
Talk about the PET scan.
Yeah. So how do you diagnose it? So that's true. To make a definitive diagnosis of Alzheimer's, you have to do an autopsy and see those plaques and tangles in the brain. However, our group, a number of years ago, we invented the first brain PET scan that allows you to visualize the plaques and tangles in living people. And now there are other scans like that that look at the plaques. And I think that's one reason that you're hearing a lot of people like Glenn Campbell or Pat mm-hmm. Summitt come out and say, I've got Alzheimer's disease, because they're doing these scans and they're detecting it earlier and earlier. Now, I'm not sure what happened in this situation where they thought it was Alzheimer's and then it was frontal temporal. Because usually those scans, and even the older PET scans, can differentiate frontal temporal dementia from Alzheimer's. Frontal temporal, so they didn't get the scan. So once they got the scan, they saw the difference. So, oh, it didn't. So why did they say it was Alzheimer's?
If they,
okay, yeah.
So
it's very...
Could have been an MRI, yeah. too.
So MRI can sometimes show it. So the diagnosis is very challenging, and we find that it's helpful when you get a more accurate diagnosis, even though the treatment may not be that different. Between frontal temporal and Alzheimer's, the treatment is a bit different, so that is helpful. But you stop the doctor shopping and going from clinic to clinic, and it really seems to help families when they get a more accurate diagnosis.
This question is a little bit related to what she just said. My mother had dementia, and what I understand is that Alzheimer's is a form of dementia, and then there's other forms of dementia as well. So you've been talking about Alzheimer's. Is the treatment in your book and the things that you do at UCLA, is that also treatment for other types of dementia, or is this specifically for Alzheimer's?
So just to clarify some of those terms, so dementia is what we used to call senility. So if somebody has a cognitive problem or memory problem, so that it causes them to be dependent on others. That's basically dementia. A lot of things can cause it. Alzheimer's is the most common cause. That's where we see the plaques and tangles in the brain. It's a gradual onset. But people can have small strokes, can cause dementia. You can have a thyroid imbalance. You can be depressed. That's why it's important to see a doctor if there's one of these problems.
But is the treatment in your book also applicable to dementia? Yeah.
So the approach, the Alzheimer's prevention program, is really tailored to people who have normal aging or might have mild cognitive impairment. However, you can adjust the program. We're talking about individualizing it. When we have people come into our clinics and they have mild dementia, we'll give them books and we'll tailor a program for them. So, you know, let's say somebody always liked reading. Well, they might read simpler kinds of novels or easier reading, adjust it to their level of cognitive functioning. And we have families, they start walking together, they all go on the diet together, they interact better, and they're doing much better. So we think this is for people regardless of their level of cognitive impairment.
Yeah, I am curious about the correlation between genetics and lifestyle, because my dad's family comes from an enclave in South Dakota. They're farmers, they're not college educated, and everyone in this enclave, whether they're Finn, Swede, or German, or Norwegian, they're living to the age of 90, 100, and none of them have Alzheimer's. None of them even have senility. They're all active. My great aunt is 103, and she lives by herself in Washington.
Where exactly is this?
Frederick, South Dakota. It's in the northeastern corner by the border with North Dakota. And it's a relatively large town. I mean, 500 people, 502.
But
even in the surrounding area and relatives, I mean, I'm practically related to half of South Dakota, and nobody has Alzheimer's out that way that was of that generation.
So that, you know, that's very interesting, and there could be several explanations. One can be the everything we're talking about, that they're physically active, that there's a social network, but also the genetic pool may be very strong, and there are some, you know, longevity genes, and there are families like this. And in fact, in some of these families, those longevity genes are so strong that even, you know, some of these people will smoke and it doesn't even affect them, that they do all the wrong things and they still do well. So I think for most people, it's probably a combination of the genetics and the lifestyle. I thought you were going to tell me about one of these families where there's a very strong family history of the disease, which is quite rare, where you have 50% of relatives affected, you know, and they get it early in life. That's a rare case where genetic counseling and genetic testing may be helpful. More often, there's a common genetic risk, we call APOE4. But even if you have that genetic risk, that's not a reason not to do the program. There's a recent study that found that if you have this genetic risk, and 20% of the population has it, that if those people with the genetic risk exercise more, they had fewer plaques in the brain. So having a genetic predisposition is not a reason not to do something about it.
Gary, I think, too, now that you're on the topic of genetics, is that people think that because they have a gene for something, that they're definitely going to get something. And so what you're talking about is two different kinds of genes, right? The first one runs heavily in families. You have a very high risk, 50% chance.
But that's only, it's less than 2%.
Like, right.
That doesn't affect most of us.
The other gene is just a susceptibility gene, right? So
it means that you have a higher probability of getting the disease at a younger age, but it's not necessary or it's not sufficient to get it. So many people with this genetic risk never get Alzheimer's in their lifetime, and many people without it do get it in their lifetime. So it's not 100%.
Linda, we're going to take two more questions.
Okay.
There was an article in the Times just lately about frontotemporal. Someone just scared the bejunior out of you if you read the article. And they mentioned that it was similar to Alzheimer's. And I thought maybe you could explain the difference between the two, and maybe Creutzfeldt-Jacob too, and whether UCLA is talking about all three.
Yeah, we're looking at all these conditions. So with frontal temporal dementia, it actually tends to affect people younger. So this person was 58, you know, in their early 60s. And it affects the front part of the brain and underneath the temples, just as the name implies. The front part of the brain is complex reasoning, personality. So we might see personality changes. It may affect language. So that may be more of the presentation than, say, the memory problem. And these people often do not respond to the memory medicines we talked about earlier, as well as people with Alzheimer's type right. dementia. Creutzfeldt-Jakob is spread by what we call a prion, kind of an infectious protein, and it's very rare. It's very aggressive, and we're trying to do research on all these kinds of dementias. We think they're all very important.
One more question.
Have there been studies done about meditation, especially long-time meditators, about Alzheimer's disease? And so, if so, how does that work exactly in the brain?
So we're not sure exactly how it works, but there have been studies of super meditators, and their brains look different. They function differently. It probably protects their brain health with that kind of approach. But I think we need to do more work on it. At UCLA, we've done more work with Tai Chi, in part because we find many Westerners, particularly older adults, prefer the movements to just sitting still and meditating. And what's interesting, not only does it seem to improve mood and probably cognitive functioning, but it, remember we talked about inflammation before, it seems to improve immune function and inflammatory responses. In fact, a lot of the Alzheimer's prevention strategies do that, whether it's physical exercise, getting a good night's sleep, or eating fish. These are all kind of anti-inflammatory strategies.
Right, so there are natural ways to get that anti-inflammatory effect without having to take an Advil, for example, or something like that. All right.
Which reminds me, I should take one of those.
Yeah. Timing. So, Gary and Gigi, it was really great to be able to sit here and talk with the two of you and to have everyone else
involved. Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Support your library and get more great friends.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.